Art Slice is a different dive into art history. We goof around, we curse, you learn from it, but don't expect a typical lecture. You're welcome. Weird question.
Okay.
But what do artists slash... blah, 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 blah. I didn't expect you to say okay. But you're the one I'm talking to.
On traveling.
Weird question.
Yeah.
What do artist slash anthropologist Miguel Covarrubias and chef slash author Anthony Bourdain have in common? Both of their careers... Both of their careers skyrocketed thanks to features in the New Yorker magazine, albeit 80 years apart. Affluent and intellectual readers of the 1920s were not prepared for Miguel's bold and witty caricatures, lightly poking fun at cultural figures, because if you weren't just a reader aspiring to be one, then you might have been the target of his pen.
Miguel was, with fresh eyes and a knack for getting to the aura of it all, documenting his experience in the concrete jungle that is New York City. Which was night and day compared to his native Mexico City. In 1999, after spending over 20 grueling years in the restaurant industry, Anthony Bourdain wiped that glossy media sheen off of celebrity chefs and an overly glamorized restaurant industry. In his tell-all article, Don't Eat This Before Reading. Spilling the beans, Stephanie, probably canned beans, masquerading as high-end heirloom beans on what really goes on in the kitchen of those $3 sign restaurants.
People were shocked. People were disgusted.
But for others, this article was a love letter to every wage worker and immigrant he scraped by with.
Both Miguel and Anthony knew how to tell a story that came from a place of love and appreciation by exploring beyond the visual stereotypes or trendy cuisines, from the unique quirks and mannerisms of movie stars and political figures to the exquisite or rotten ingredients or the blood and sweat of the staff making your overpriced dish. This no-frills look at their perspective, microcosmos.
Yeah.
allowed them to expand their talents and experiment with storytelling far beyond the borders of the U.S. or Mexico.
Both evolved into almost a new type of like cultural anthropological hybrid creature, using their shared love of visual and culinary arts to connect with people who they would never have connected with otherwise, giving us, the audience, a view of the shared humanity, especially in places that the media has either never shed a light on or only shed like negative light on because of our, you know, Western imperial lens. Oscillating between micro moments of connection and macro views of how this all connects us no matter where we're from.
The micro-macro-rena.
Yeah, the macro-rena.
But lesser known are the women in their lives. Mm. Anthony Bourdain's wife pushed him to write that explosive article, and Miguel would never have reached the heights of his acclaim without collaborating with his partner, Rosa Rolanda. I'm Stephanie Duenas.
I'm Russell Shoemaker.
And very soon, we will be joined by Mexican art historian, author, curator, podcaster, and cultural content creator, Becca Duncan. If you're new here, welcome. Mm. This show is not an art history lecture, nor is it a one-minute short that reduces an artist to bullet points with little to no context.
Settle in. Get your butts in the seats.
Yes, these
Get your earbuds cozy.
Yes, these artists deserve your full attention. Okay, and we will let our personalities and perspectives tell the story. But we also want to hear your thoughts. So that is what you're getting served here at Art... Sorry.
Go on.
Okay. So that is what you're getting served here at the Art Slice Diner on La Isla de Art Slice.
Michelin star rated, I'm sure, podcast.
Definitely, definitely. And today we are serving Miguel Covarrubias, who technically is part of a two-course meal, Rosa being the first course. So if you caught our last episode on Rosa Rolanda, you will know that before the Mexican power couple Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera, there was Rosa Rolanda and Miguel Covarrubias, a type of collaborative duo rarely, if ever, seen in art history. Rosa, a dazzling Mexican-American dancer from the West Coast, shot to fame on Broadway with her anti-ballet moves. Miguel, a.k.a. El Chamaco, or The Kid, an artist from Ciudad de México.
I'm Mexico City.
So then Mexico, who upon his arrival in New York City,
New York City,
quickly became a sensation for his witty caricatures featured on the pages of Vanity Fair and The New Yorker. These two talented individuals would inevitably cross paths, and cross paths they did in 1926. Falling in love, Rosa and Miguel eventually tied the knot and honeymooned in Bali, beginning their lifelong love and appreciation for the island. So much so, it resulted in a return journey and a unique three-ish year collaboration.
In a book called The Island of Bali, all about the customs and everyday life of the Balinese culture, written and illustrated by Miguel, with over 100 photographs by Rosa. This type of book was like the first of its kind and one that is still referenced to this day, actually. And it was one of a kind because, like Anthony Bourdain and in his love of food, Rosa and Miguel, being artists, really connected with the Balinese people.
This was the beginning of the creative and adventure-filled life they would build together, as Miguel's talent and charismatic persona began to earn him more acclaim. Opportunities kept rolling in.
Rolling.
Yeah, rolling them to Japan, Tunisia, China, and the Philippines, and many parts of Mexico. Rosa left her dancing days behind and fully embraced her life alongside Miguel, but continued to support him behind the scenes while also exploring other art forms like photography and painting. Neither Miguel or Rosa's creative output would have been the same without the other, which led to Miguel's successful and prolific career in many pursuits, going on to be described as Mexico's 20th century Renaissance man.
Ooh, it's kind of like a 30 under 30 for the kid there.
Kind of, right? Yeah. Kind of.
Forbes. Forbes.
Yeah. But the truth is, his legacy goes far beyond Mexico. So those of you in Texas may know him from his incredible 12 by 60 foot glass mosaic, Genesis, The Gift of Life, outside of the entrance of the Dallas Museum of Art from 1954, which is the length of over half of a blue whale, which is the biggest whale on the planet.
Interesting measurement.
Isn't that crazy? You might be wondering, Stephanie, that's such a weird way to measure a mural. Just know that the idea for this mural came from a very small tempera painting on paper, which was then blown up to whale-sized proportions and executed using thousands of tiny pieces of glass.
Is that what he wrote down?
Or tesserae.
Blow up to whale-sized proportion, please.
Por favor.
Yeah. this mural has the brilliance of Ravenna, but instead of Big J, grown-up J, not BBJ, and his DC talk crew in the Christian posse, Miguel highlights Mesoamerican and Native American symbols to explore the idea of a genesis through the perspectives of indigenous cultures. Mm-hmm. The four elements, water, earth, fire, and air, dominate the composition. And in the center, we have thriving crops like wheat, maize, citrus, sunflower, and cotton. Above them, a Zuni rainbow man zooms above the earth. Mm-hmm. An ancient Mexican god lurks beneath the crops. And between the flames and the wind star, there is a red sun that looks very similar to the Zia sun symbol, made up of a red circle with four sets of four rays emanating in four directions. Lots of four. Four is a sacred number for the Zia people. Americans might recognize this from the New Mexico state flag or Blake's Lotaburger. God damn, I need a Blake's Lotaburger. I need a lot of Blake's Lotaburger. Okay. When we first saw his work, a huge mural map of North America showing the lineage of folk art throughout the continent at the Museum of Folk Art in Mexico City, we were struck with how he was able to tie geography to biodiversity, to culture, to art, literally showing how it traveled and evolved in each region. But this year's retrospective of his work, A View Without Borders, just took that strength of Miguel's work and exploded it right in front of our eyes.
Blew it up to whale-sized proportions.
Exactly. Highlighting how his work connects through all sorts of cultures in a time when globalization and societal flattening hadn't sunk its claws into the entire globe yet. In other words, a time before you would arrive in any city anywhere in the world, finding nearly identical white box minimalist fourth wave coffee shops, blending industrial motifs with more naturalistic brutalist seating, which is a blessing and a curse because I do need my leche de avena in my cafecito.
Leche de avena?
Yes, that's okay. What I said.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure I said that. I don't know why I had to say it again. I said it.
What? Just making sure.
Okay. You give me the same look that the barista gave me when I ordered it.
I'm sure that's not the case at all. When we walked into the show Una Mirada Sin Fronteras at the Palacio de Cultura Banamex, we were met with two massive murals, okay, even massiver than the Museum of Folk Arts one, which just enveloped our periphery, okay, and we were transported into a bird's eye view of the Pacific Ocean and its salty reaches.
Salt reaches far.
It does. In fact, this mural, Flora and Fauna of the Pacific, and the other one in the show, People of the Pacific, were part of a six-part series commissioned for the 1939 Golden Gate International Exposition in San Francisco.
We don't have to say San Francisco, right? It's too many. We got too many cities every week, you know.
I know, right? Okay. SFSF. Okay.
Is there a good San Francisco? Oh, there is, isn't there?
I don't know.
It's Rice Aroni, the San Francisco treat.
Don't know.
No, well, I've been there. I'll clip it in. I don't know if we can say it, though, guys. There's a lot of cities we repeat.
It's too many cities. Okay. This series was called Pageant of the Pacific, where Miguel illustrates the people, art forms, economy, dwellings, and means of transportation in those countries.
I like the idea of a pageant of the Pacific.
Yeah, pageant.
You know, just see them, like,
word.
You know, ambling down the streets.
With music playing.
Music playing. Anyway, yeah. The fauna and flora of these murals took me back to, like, when I was a kid and had, like, Nat Geo. I think it was Nat Geo or Wildlife Explorer.
Okay.
And there were these, like, cards you would collect in the mail. It came in the mail. It was physical. You held it in
snail
your
mail.
Hands. Yes, yes.
Was there a snail in it at one point?
Sure there was a snail. There was probably a snail, yes.
Part of the cards, not in real life.
It's probably one of those Australian snails, the big ones. I'm forgetting the name of them right now.
No.
But anyway, you would collect them kind of like cards in, like, a little plastic bin, and then you could look through all the animals you collected.
That is really fun.
Yeah, it's fun. I wish I had that still.
It's really hard not to feel awe and wonder when looking at these. It makes me wish that I had learned from these as a kid rather than boring textbooks.
Yeah.
And honestly, it has inspired me to bring back the old animal bucket list because I'd forgotten just how cool our planet is.
You have an animal bucket list?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And you didn't have Wildlife Explorer / Nat Geo? You just kind of came up with that on your own?
That was before my time.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Nah, I don't think so.
Yeah.
We're not that. Our age is not that different.
You're not good
You'd
at
like
math.
You'd like to think, whatever. You may look younger than me, but we're not that far apart.
Okay. You know who is featured on my bucket list? That puffin right there. Look at that puffin. Cute puffy puffin.
Squeeze it.
Okay, exactly.
Squeeze it. Watch the life leave its eyes.
And we lived like 2 hours away from the puffins, and we never went to see them. I will never forgive myself. Anyway, moving on. How about that pink empanada with blue tentacles? How about that? My algorithm is not filled with these cool creatures, okay? It's just cats.
Yeah, silly you gotta get yourself a little less AI silly cats and more wildlife Nat Geo Explorer cards.
Yeah, that's some good advice.
Yeah, we're gonna get on eBay after this.
This mural is one of my favorites because not only are Miguel's flora and fauna scientifically accurate, like James Audubon's, Maria Sibylla Marion's, or Fernando, okay, se llama Fernando Bauer. Okay, 1, 2, 3.
Bauer.
1, 2. Okay. Or Ferdinand Bauer's.
Yeah, and they also are vibrant and playful, like Wanda Gogg's prints of the of fantastical nature.
Yes.
Very realistically rendered, but silly and fun.
Well, so he might subtly tweak a certain feature or quality. Okay, like he might enlarge a head or some eyes to make him appear slightly cartoony.
Like I said, Warner Gog.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then his brilliant use of color just goes boom. Kaboom.
Okay. Goes boom. All right.
Booms your socks off. Blows your socks off.
Booms your sock off. Okay.
Booms your socks off.
Your one sock.
Well, now I do. After witnessing this color, yes, I do.
All right.
But honestly, you could say the same thing about Rose's works. Both she and Miguel focused on capturing not just the sitter's, you know, clothing, accessories, and the background, but also their affect, right? Their aura, as well as every other element of the composition. And they worked so closely together that it was inevitable. Kind of like those couples that eventually start to dress like one another.
Yeah. Yeah, Stephanie.
I wouldn't know about that.
Yeah, she copies all my clothing. We kind of look like Tomax and Zamot when we go to Costco.
Who's that?
It's unsettling. They're from G.I. Joe. It's a long, old, it's old.
Okay.
Old. No, I don't think anybody knows my references anymore. I'm realizing I'm referencing.
Are you doing the math
everything
finally?
Everything from like the what?
Are you doing the math finally?
Yeah, sure. Doing the math.
Anyway,
you know what, listeners? Let me know if you know who Tomax and Zamot are, okay? And let me know if you see them in Costco because they're probably Stephanie and I.
Okay. It's clear
that I buy
that
Keens, she buys Keens. I buy cool pants, she buys the same cool pants.
I buy cool sneakers, you buy cool sneakers.
No. It's always, once. Once.
Okay. It is clear that both of them are passionate and curious about the places and people that they met.
And as for Miguel and the Pacific murals, they are a macro view of his micro works exploring the places these people, flora, and fauna are all from.
But back to that childlike awe and wonder.
Aria.
While Miguel is now known for surpassing borders and elevating foreign cultures, as was the theme of the show, these murals were a culmination of years of observations, Miguel's first inspiration came from home, specifically the nightlife of Ciudad de Mexico. Ciudad de Mexico. In a time when, as a young boy, he would often skip school to watch rehearsals at a local theater. Mm. That rigid structure of Catholic school wasn't for 14-year-old Miguel. Mm. And after
he's not a kid.
Not yet, though.
Okay.
He's not a chamaco.
He's not the kid yet. He's actually a kid, but he's not the kid.
Correct. Yeah.
Confusing.
So, yeah.
Go on.
Hated school. After a tiff with a teacher, it ended with him whacking his teacher on the cabeza on the head with a ruler, and it cracked his skull, the teacher.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Chamaco skull cracker.
I just feel bad for the teachers listening right now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I hope that never happens to any of you. Bless you, teachers. You're doing amazing work. Mm-hmm.
Dodging rulers.
Miguel breaking his teacher's skull open is kind of a foreshadowing, right? Because he was going to break preconceived notions using his tools. I'll see myself out now. Okay. All right. So Miguel, understandably, was mortified. And since he already hated school, he never went back. Mm-hmm. His parents didn't fight him on it. And instead, his papa, who held a very important position in the government.
Oh, that's why he didn't get in trouble for the ruler cracking. The skull cracking.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Do you know who my father is? I'm just kidding. I don't know.
He has that kind of face.
No, he doesn't.
I could see it.
No, he doesn't.
I could see it. He's got a nice face, but I could see it.
No.
I'm just saying I could see it, his face turn. He's got a charming face. Look at him there. Look at him there. Do you know who my father is? See, isn't it so important that I found this photo? Sorry, if you didn't listen to the last episode, you don't understand our argument here.
You don't understand why his tone of voice is as such.
He said it wasn't important. Anyway, go on.
All right. His dad got teenage Miguel a job as a map draftsman. Okay. So while that might have been boring, this did instill a love of maps in Miguel, and it set the tone.
Neglect is autism. Sorry. I'm sorry. He's an artist. Why are you taking a drink?
Okay. Okay.
He liked maps.
He liked maps.
All right.
Okay. And this set the tone.
Does he have any drawings of trains? Probably does. Car drawings. Okay, sorry, go on.
I don't know. So, this love of maps set the tone for his life's work. And while teen Miguel learned the precision and techniques of drafting maps, after hours, he spent his time in the bumpin' cafes like El Monote, observing and absorbing the streets of night, of which cultural intellectuals and artists, including José Clemente Orozco and Diego Rivera, were regulars. Mm. While befriending singers, dancers, actors, and comedians, including Cantinflas, it was here he earned the nickname El Chamaco.
Oh, okay.
There it is.
Yeah.
As he was probably the youngest person in the room, fervently sketching away in his husky boy shorts.
Where he kept his maps. Because they're cargo shorts.
Cargo dress shorts. That is an oxymoron. Okay. When he wasn't in a cafe putting pencil to paper, you could find him in a theater watching a vaudeville act as much as a zarzuela performance or hastily sketching theatergoers.
Okay.
It was clear that El Chamaco had found his cha haystack feeling. Yeah.
See what you did there.
You did. Yeah. You saw. Good, good. So his cha haystack was capturing people, right? Enjoying life or celebrating their culture. He soon combined his technical skills with the visions of life that soon after took him to New York City.
So it's there where he would start illustrating those movie stars, socialites, politicians, evangelists. How do I say it?
Evangelists,
mobsters, illustrating them in contradictory pairings as part of his brilliant character series, Impossible Interviews. Think like psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud and old Hollywood star Gene Harlow, Clark Gables and Edward, the Prince of Wales, Joseph Stalin, surrealist influence fashion designer Elsa Schiaparelli, Huey Long, Benito Mussolini, odd pairings. You get it. It's odd pairings.
Right.
Dead or alive, young or old, familiar or foreign, there is a conversation or maybe a fistfight to be had.
So this brilliant slash amazing slash fantastic idea even inspired the 2012 Met exhibition, Schiaparelli and Prada, Impossible Conversations, which explore the similarities between Miuccia Prada, of Prada, still living, breathing, and making Italian fashion as of this recording, with the deceased iconic surrealist Italian fashion designer, Elsa Schiaparelli, known for her collabs with Dali and Cocteau. But back to Miguel's caricatures. While Impossible Interviews was poking fun at pop cultural figures, Miguel had a different approach when it came to his Harlem Renaissance works. Naturally, his love of performance, theater, and art led him to Harlem, which was experiencing its own renaissance, much like Mexico City. The music, the acrobatic dance, the people, and the fashion all fascinated Miguel, resulting in a new, dynamic representation of Black folks. And while his drawings were certainly subverting the typical crude stereotypes, some criticized them, like W.E.B. Du Bois, and others celebrated them, like poet Langston Hughes or writer Zora Neale Hurston, who you may know from Their Eyes Were Watching God. Miguel would go on to illustrate the covers of their books The Weary Blues and Mules of Men. Author and playwright County Cullen said of Miguel's work, quote, "This young Mexican has an uncanny feeling for the comical essence behind those characters he chooses to portray. He does not choose to portray all, however, apparently finding the most interesting types in the cabarets. He is especially successful in capturing the illusion of motion." End quote.
So that is our very, very limited introduction to Miguel. He made so much work, so much work. But the thread is finding the value, the humanity, and the humor in the people, places, and things that inhabit this planet that we all call home. Challenging us to look past borders to find that shared humanity, very similar to how Anthony Bourdain did. And it's also the fucking medicine that we need to force feed the whole world right now. Just cram it down their throats. Everybody, everybody take your medicine. For the love of God, everything's crazy right now. Take your goddamn medicine.
Sugar, makes the
Sorry.
Medicine
yeah,
go
make,
down.
Makes it go
okay,
down.
Okay, all right, enough.
Sorry, we gotta
we
get Becca.
We need to get Becca, who has way more insight than us clowns do. Okay, but just as a quick aside, if you're still wondering why the heck did we rope in Anthony Bourdain, well, we were actually in Chiang Mai, Thailand at the Cowboy Hat Lady stand.
Kau Ka Moo, I think it's called.
Which actually was featured in one of Bourdain's episodes. That was the night that we all found out that he passed. And we don't speak Thai, despite
I just spoke a little bit there.
You did. Yeah. You did. That is true. Just kidding. Don't please delete that. Wow. Okay. Wow. Anyway, we don't speak Thai. But it was clear that there was this sadness in the air, and it honestly just goes to show you the power of body language, because sometimes you don't need words to communicate.
Yeah, art, culture, it's this connector to people, to like real people. Appreciating craft like brings light to their lives. And life is short, like making art, even if that's just like a delicious stewed pork leg with rice and delicious pickled mustard. I'm hungry now, but it's sharing your talent with the world in like a meaningful way.
Which is amazing.
And Miguel and Rosa did that. They share their talents with others and they work to show the talents of other artists.
Right. They put on dance performances. They painted portraits of their friends or of whole ass continents. They wrote books to spread the nuance of cultures.
Yeah. And through that, they brought humanity spread miles and miles apart a little bit closer and made the world a little bit better.
Like we mentioned, if you haven't checked out our last episode on Rosa Rolanda, you probably want to do that. But let's get into our conversation with Becca Duncan. She's going to give us even more insight on this artist power couple.
Listeners, we forgot to mention, you don't just have to be listeners. You can actually watch this if you want to see all of the images we discuss. If you're listening on Spotify, you can switch audio to video, or you can go to YouTube to watch the video there. And if you are one of those watchers, not listeners, watching on YouTube, go ahead and hit the like button and leave a comment. Thanks.
We would like to give an Art Slice welcome to Becca Duncan, art historian, author, curator, journalist, and cultural content creator. Did I get everything?
I think so, yeah. Okay. Well, you know, that's what happens when you study history or art history. You have to do a whole lot of things to survive.
Yes. It's really exciting talking to you today because we actually were wrapping up that episode on Rosa Rolanda and we found you doing research on her. There's not that much out there in English, so it was really fun to find your work. But also, we have an upcoming episode on Diego Rivera's underwater mural.
Oh, yeah.
El Agua Origen de la Vida. And we found your video, or El Foco's video on that, too. So
we both found you separately.
Yes, we did.
I was like, so I don't speak Spanish. I was like, Stephanie, can you please translate?
Yeah, I'll do my best. Yeah, but after seeing the Miguel Covarrubias show in Mexico City, which is called Una Mirada Sin Fronteras, which roughly translates to A Look Without Borders, correct me if I'm wrong one. Yes, so after seeing that, we wanted to talk to you about how he and Rosa inspired each other as a couple, but also dive into Miguel's work a little bit.
Yeah, because we don't get too far into Miguel's work. We mostly talk about how they met. But yeah, so we wanted to spend some more time with Miguel.
Yeah.
I love that. I'm a huge fan of both of them. And I actually think it's when you think about art power couples in Mexico, obviously everybody thinks of Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera. Yeah. But to me, they're like right there at the top. They were so talented and so interesting. I'm surprised that there's very little about them. And I'm very happy that the show happened because I hope new generations of art fans will become interested in his work.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you know, or do you have an idea of why it's taken so long for him to have such a huge retrospective in Mexico, given his, you know, that he's from Mexico City and he has a lot of work and did a lot in Mexico?
Yeah. I mean, I think his work is very recognized in the anthropology and archaeology world. Mm. So I think his research on Mexico's ancient cultures and what he proposed about those cultures have had a huge repercussions in that world. But unfortunately, I get a feeling that when it comes to his art, we have a bit of an ambivalent relationship with his work in the sense that he's not as popular as other artists like Diego Rivera, José Clemente Orozco, David Alfaro Siqueiros, these kind of big macho muralist painters. Yep. Mm-hmm. I think it has to do with their personality in contrast to Miguel's personality, in the sense that they were very public, they were very political, they were very close to power in that way. And although Miguel was also left-leaning in his ideology, he was also interested in communism as the muralist painters. Mm-hmm. His work isn't that political, if you think about it. Or it is maybe in a very subtle way. So he wasn't doing these very big ideological paintings, murals, that kind of thing. And although he was, of course, close to politics and power, because at that time in Mexico, and I would say, unfortunately, still today, to be successful as an artist, you do have to kind of flirt with politicians. I feel like he wasn't very much out there in his political ideals, and he wasn't doing political work. And so I think he didn't get into this narrative of like the official Mexican art that was linked to the revolutionary movement as the other painters were. And I think also the fact that a lot of his work dealt with foreign cultures. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, he was very important in the research and study of Mexico's pre-Hispanic cultures. But he was also doing a lot of work. Well, his first work was in New York. He was doing work about the cultures in the Pacific in his trip to Bali. So I think he had a broader perspective in the world at the time when Mexico was really only looking at itself. And I think maybe that also made him kind of marginalized in this narrative of Mexican art.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because you see all his work for, and I'm not sure how this lines up timeline-wise, but you see all his work for like Vanity Fair, Forbes, The New Yorker. Do you think that had anything to do with maybe him not being as prominent in Mexico City? Or because I know Diego obviously went a lot of places. He worked for the Rockefellers, Henry Ford, those kind of people as well. But do you think that played a small role in his kind of exclusion from the broader narrative there?
Yeah, I think what happened in time is like it's not like he was at the time an outsider in a way, because I can tell you, I've done a lot of research in newspapers. So I can tell you that the work that he was doing in New York at the time, illustrating for these magazines, did have a repercussion here. I mean, he was a character that was written about in the Mexican press. Like, look at what this really young Mexican guy is doing in the US, right? So that was something that I think Mexican art critics and artists did feel very proud of, that he was having that impact as a Mexican abroad. I mean, there was interviews with him. They would sometimes even publish his cartoons that he would do for other magazines and newspapers in the US here in Mexico. So he wasn't like out of the art circuits. I think it's more like what happened afterwards in the way that the Mexican art history was built, very much in line with the, like I said, the official political narrative. Because you have to understand that in Mexico, after the revolution, and I'm sorry to give like a little history lesson here.
No, please.
No, please.
But as a historian, it's what I do. It's what I love to do. So Mexico had the revolutionary movement from 1910 to 1917, right? That's kind of the span of this. And then the characters that started the revolution were in power after that. Mm-hmm. And it's like a whole set of generals and, you know, military characters that went into power. And they formed a party. That party eventually became the PRI. And PRI, it would translate as an institutional revolutionary party. They were in power until the year 2000. Okay, so a lot of these artists, like I mentioned, were very inspired by the revolution. Some of them even participated directly in the revolutionary movement, or they were very inspired by that as communist artists, as most artists at the time were part of the Communist Party. They saw in the revolution kind of like the new hope for the Mexican future, for what Mexico had to be as a country. It started also a big movement to turn to the indigenous cultures and to our pre-Hispanic roots to sort of find the true Mexican culture. And Covarrubias was also a part of that. But what happened in time is that they sort of became the official artists, the ones that were doing, like Diego, murals about the revolution or paintings about the revolution, like this new moment of hope for the future of Mexico and what was coming. And so I think in that they sort of became part of the political system and they became part of that official narrative of this party that was, as Mario Vargas Llosa, the Peruvian writer, once said, the perfect dictatorship, because it was a party dictatorship. It wasn't, I mean, you kind of felt that there was a change in presidents and there was kind of a democracy, but it was always the same party in power.
Sure.
And I think Covarrubias, because he was doing this international work, he didn't fit into that narrative. So I feel like it's not that his work wasn't important during his time. I think it was afterwards, when the sort of like official art history of Mexico was written, he was kind of left out.
And is that the same time that, because I know through Stephanie talking to me about it, that a lot of women artists were left out too. Is that the time as well when more of the Mexican women artists were left out? Is that kind of what your research is on?
Yeah, well, I've been researching women artists at the time. And in a lot of them, it really has to do with like this patriarchal system, you know? The muralist movement was like the official artistic movement of the revolutionary period and of this revolutionary government, right? So on the one hand, if you weren't doing these very big public works of art, like the murals were, then you were kind of left out. But then at the same time, the men that controlled this, that were basically Diego, Siqueiros, Orozco, these men, they wouldn't really let women into that movement very easily. And they would sometimes even purposely leave them out. That's the case, for example, very famous case with María Izquierdo. She was going to do, she was going to be the first female artist to do a large scale mural in a public building in Mexico City. And they started a smear campaign against her in the press until the Mexico City government, the mayor, canceled her work. So it was very much a macho movement, you know? So lots of women were left out of that like official movement, with some few exceptions. Most of the exceptions were students of Diego Rivera. They were okay. But then any other female artists were not okay because they weren't aligning to their ideas. And then as they were doing basically, you know, oil paintings, smaller formats, then they were also kind of left out of that official movement. So I think it has to do a lot with ideology, and it also has to do with just the patriarchal system of the time.
Thanks. I know that's a little sidetrack question.
That's super interesting. I'm going to go back to the medium. Is it just clicked for me? So we've covered a couple of illustrators this year, and we've noticed that they've been Well, they've been overlooked and they've definitely been left out by the canon, and their work is amazing. And they did so much in their lifetime. And we're like, well, why haven't we heard of them? And I think you touched on it. It has something to do with the medium, because Miguel was super successful, but he used illustration to kind of cross different disciplines. Like, he kind of brought like anthropology together with illustration. And my point is like, he was able to branch out to like books, to smaller drawings, to big murals, but it wasn't like big macho
frescoes.
And, and he was also younger, right? He was really young, or younger than the three anyway. So maybe those two things had something to do with that.
Yeah, well, he was about 20 years younger, at least, than Diego Rivera. Wow. So he was born in 1904. Diego Rivera was born in 1886. I can't remember the birth dates of all of the others, but I do remember this one. And so he was younger. That's actually why they called him El Chamaco. That was his nickname, because chamaco is kind of like slang, colloquial word for saying like a young kid or a young guy. Yeah, it was kind of like kid. That would, I think, would be the translation. So he was a lot younger, and he was experimenting with a lot of formats. And yes, I think that also has to do with why he's been left out, because like I said, muralism was very much at the center of art at the time. Politically, but also artistically, it was very important, because you have to imagine that the Mexican muralist movement, when it started in 1921, 1922, those 2 years, basically, it was the most important avant-garde movement in Latin America. And it was actually considered the first avant-garde movement in Latin America, or at least the first one to have kind of like a ripple effect in the global north, to say it in a way. In like in Western art. So it was having an impact in the US. It was also having an impact in Europe. And that was the first time that that happened, because usually in this kind of like colonial dynamic, it was always Mexico and Latin America that would sort of receive the influence of the artistic movements of the West and the North and adapt it to a local taste. And this was the first time that it was happening the other way around. So you had that very important kind of like international soft power of the muralist movement, which also meant that there was a lot of interest in Mexico from abroad. People were coming either just to spend short periods, or actually people were migrating to Mexico, artists, intellectuals, poets, you know, to start doing their work here, because they were very impressed by what was happening here. And then at the same time, like I mentioned, it did have this very intricate relationship with the revolutionary governments. So you have to imagine that, I mean, the muralist movement, to me, it can be contested as an avant-garde movement, because it was a movement started by the state, actually. Oh, it was started by the Ministry of Education. Yeah. So it was the state was paying these painters to make these very big public works of art, because in the revolutionary mindset, the idea was that art had to be accessible to everybody, not only to the elite, as it was in the previous regime. So that was very important. To sort of become a consecrated artist was to do murals. And then there's something to say about the technique, actually, which is very important. Fresco is a very difficult technique. So if you were able to do frescoes, that was basically kind of like crowning yourself as a great master. And it was very much in dialogue with Renaissance art. So actually the muralist movement at first was called the Mexican Renaissance. And so you're kind of at the level of Michelangelo if you're able to do frescoes, right?
For sure.
So if you're not doing that, then, or you can't, then in a way you're kind of accepting that you're a minor artist, you know?
Okay. Gotcha.
I mean, in the mindset of the time.
Yeah.
So I think that could also add to why Miguel Covarrubias and a lot of other illustrators and graphic artists were overseen throughout the years.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of international movements, Miguel, being in New York, had a lot of exposure to New York, like peak New York in the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, very opulent. And you know that he had experience with the Harlem Renaissance. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about that, because he definitely contributed some to it.
I think before going into like the Harlem Renaissance, I would just like to make a very quick parenthesis of why Covarrubias was in New York and how he also managed to get into those artistic circles. And there we have to mention a couple of Mexican artists and intellectuals that were very, very important, among them José Juan Tablada. So in a way, Covarrubias goes to New York because there's already a migration of Mexican artists and poets and et cetera in New York. And Tablada was very important there. He was actually in New York exiled because during the whole turmoil in the revolution, he sided with a character, Victoriano Huerta, that was basically a traitor, Francisco Madero, who started the revolution. Mm-hmm. So as an ally of Huerta, who assassinated Madero, he had to flee Mexico. This was in 1913. So he established himself in New York. He had a bookshop there. And going to New York to see him was a bit of a pilgrimage for certain people in the artistic and intellectual world in Mexico, right? So a lot of people started going to New York to see him. And among them, there's a couple of very interesting people, Mario de Sayas. Mario de Sayas is somebody who has been studied a lot by Antonio Saborit. You can find his books on him. And he was also an artist. He was also doing illustration and cartoons. He was exhibiting his work in New York. He was very much in tune with like the avant-garde movements in Europe as well. And Adolfo Best Mogard. And it's Best Mogard who really introduces Miguel Covarrubias to a lot of the cultural scene in New York. And he gets Miguel involved also in his own work because Adolfo Best Mogard was doing a lot of things for theater and dance shows. So he was doing, forgot the word in Spanish, it's escenografía. Basically like the backdrops, the
set design.
Set design?
Yeah, the set design, exactly. So Best Mogard was doing a lot of the set design in Broadway and, you know, these new kind of like dance and theater shows. It's actually him that introduces Miguel to Rosa Rolanda.
Okay.
Because they know each other from the theater, right? And and Broadway and that world when Rosa was still a dancer. And so Miguel Covarrubias arrives to New York with a group that is already involved in the artistic scene there and that opens doors to him. And what's interesting about them is particularly Best Mogard. Best Mogard is already somebody who's looking to indigenous cultures. He is going to be one of the most important people in sort of revaluing or revitalizing Mexican crafts. So understanding Mexican traditional indigenous crafts as art. He's going to study that very, very, very profoundly. And so it's a group that's already kind of, in a way, having sort of like an anthropological perspective on the world, you know? And so I think that also inspires Miguel Covarrubias. And he, of course, had a great sensibility to that. And you can see it in his work about the Harlem Renaissance. He's doing cartoons, but in a way, he's also doing anthropology, you know? Mm-hmm. He's really trying to understand the social cultural phenomenon behind the jazz movement and the poetry and everything that's happening in Harlem. So I think it's important to understand it in that context. And I think what he does is coming from the Mexican context, I think his perspective and his view on the Harlem Renaissance is also very interesting. I feel like I can understand why he somehow relates to that, understands it, coming from a colonial background himself.
For sure.
So, I mean, Miguel Covarrubias came from an elite family. He was posh. I mean, he wasn't indigenous. That's important to say, right?
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, so his experience was, of course, very different to the experience of African Americans. But I think he did have that sensibility because in Mexico, we have, of course, that very important heritage from the indigenous cultures that we have a very sort of like everyday relationship with it. And then, of course, again, coming from a colonial history, I think that made him realize that what was happening there was important and it was worth documenting and also worth disseminating.
That makes so much sense. I'm glad that you gave us that context as to how that group of people sort of shaped the way that he, I mean, basically the rest of his career. So thank you for filling in those gaps for us. Yeah. And I had to wonder, how in the world did this young artist from Mexico get involved in the New York City Broadway scene, like designing sets? Because he designed sets and costumes for like Josephine Baker. I mean, that's huge. But inevitably, yeah, I could see how that's how he meets Rosa. So was, I guess, dance and theater something that, well, it was a shared interest of theirs, but how do you think that inspired their work?
So Rosa is about 10 years older than Miguel, which is quite exceptional at the time, I think. So for that reason, she also had a decade, maybe more, no, a decade in New York before Miguel Covarrubias arrives. So she already knows the Broadway scene perfectly. Mm-hmm. So Rosa comes from California. She is maybe one of the original Chicanas, actually, because she's from Los Angeles or that area. And her mother is Mexican. Her father is from Scotland. And she starts studying dance very young. She then moves to New York with her teacher, her dance teacher, Marion Morgan. And she starts this dance company, the Marion Morgan Dancers, that was very important at the time. And so she was already well known. By the time she meets Miguel, she's already working solo. So she had already gone through the Marion Morgan Dancers, the Siegfried Follies, and she was a solo dancer doing her own show since 1918. So when Covarrubias arrives in 1923, like I said, Rosa already has her own career in dance and theater. She had already done also silent films, so she was a bit of a star already. The contact there, like I mentioned, is Adolfo Besmogard. Now, I don't exactly know why Besmogard starts doing set design in New York, but I know that the moment when his path crosses Rosa's is when Anna Pavlova, the very famous Russian ballet dancer, does a show inspired in Mexico. Besmogard did the set design. And Rosa Rolanda at that moment is starting to use her Mexican background as part of her sort of performances, but also as part of her character. She would dress up in like a Spanish style, kind of like a Spanish gypsy style. And then she would also have where they would describe her Aztec, you know, like an Aztec dancer. So she was already kind of like using that as part of her dance persona. So what I understand is that she kind of says, why is this Russian suddenly doing a Mexican show? Like, you know, where's this coming from? And why am I not doing it, you know? And so what I understand is that it's from that moment that she contacts Besmogard, thinking about doing her own Mexican-inspired show. And she wants him to do the sets. And Besmogard at the time is living with Miguel Covarrubias. So they share a flat, Covarrubias and Besmogard. So that's probably how Miguel Covarrubias gets involved in set design, is because he's living with Besmogard. He probably needs money and he starts working with him, you know? And to me, dance, which will be one of his main interests from that moment on, really has to do with his relationship with Rosa Rolanda. I think she is definitely the person who introduces him to the dance world and also to teach him about dance, because he becomes, you know, an expert. He even directs a dance school, very important dance school here in Mexico. He becomes the director. He continues to do sets for dance shows throughout his career. But I really think it's her who introduces him to that world.
Those are some of my favorite pieces in the show, too. Illustrations of the dance studios and the illustrations of the dance.
Like the coffee sketches.
Yeah. They're so wonderful.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm so sorry. I cut you off.
I was just going to say, you can really see there that he understands the movement of the body.
Yes, he does. And actually, I wanted to ask you, speaking of dance, I know that Rosa was really interested in Asian-inspired dances. Where would she have seen or learned about such a dance? Because didn't she have a dance where she used like some kind of fire sticks or something, something like with flames? So I was so we were wondering, like, where could she have learned about that? Because maybe, you know, did that inspire their trip to Bali, her interest in East Asian dances? Okay.
Definitely. Bali was her idea all along.
Okay.
Makes sense.
So what I understand is that this was actually because of her teacher, Marion Morgan.
Mm. Okay.
So we need to go back a while in time. So the 1910, that decade, Rosa is studying in a school in Los Angeles called the Manual Arts High School. And it's kind of like an arts school, right? Mm. So she has a lot of different disciplines that she is taught, but she focuses in dance and gymnastics. But she also was taught to paint, to sew. So she actually was able to make her own costumes. That's why she also then became a painter, because she had somehow trained academically in painting as well. So in that school, Marion Morgan was a dance teacher, the dance and gymnastics teacher. So she eventually does a summer course with Marion Morgan in Berkeley. So she takes some of her most, her excelled students to this course in Berkeley. And from what I've read, and this is something that I think Adriana Williams has written about. Adriana Williams knew Rosa Rolanda, so she's one of the experts on her. It was Marion Morgan who started introducing them in this course in Berkeley to, again, what they would call primitive dances, right? Mm-hmm. So the Pacific, Asia, Africa, and of course, Rosa herself became very interested in Latin America as well because of her background. But the interest in the Pacific cultures really came from Marion Morgan. And then when they went to New York, she was still interested in that. Even though she left the company eventually, she was still very interested in that. She had learned a lot, and apparently she would also go to like the Metropolitan Museum to, you know, look at all the works of art of ancient cultures there. So she was still very interested in studying these cultures and understanding their dance rituals and dance traditions. That's why she was also very interested in going to the Pacific Islands and Bali in particular. And it's not until she marries Covarrubias that they go together.
Mm-hmm.
But that had been an interest of hers for a while. And she is the one who introduces him to that. So she actually, I mean, she is a very big influence in his work and the person he will become, you know?
Seems like that.
And sometimes I think that's overlooked. And I feel the exhibition in Banamex didn't really do justice to that. I mean, she's mentioned in the works that they did in collaboration, particularly the book on Bali. Mm-hmm. But she really introduces him to a lot of things that would mark, I mean, not only his interests, but his work.
Rosa's photographs for the Bali book are incredible. Mm-hmm. Like, I love his illustrations for the book, but her photographs really are really, really incredible.
It would not be the same book without her photographs.
Yeah, I was just going to say, what's very interesting about those photographs, I feel, it's also that kind of feminine sensibility where I think she understood that photography can be very aggressive, you know? It's like very in your face. And so she tried to be as subtle as possible when she approached people to photograph. And what I was reading is that that also had to do with the format of her camera, because she used a Rolleiflex. And that camera, you have it kind of like a chest level, so it's not in your face.
You hang it
on your neck, and you have it on your chest, and then kind of like a flap comes out.
Okay.
And you look down into a mirror, so that allows you to do it in a way that's like almost like the perfect paparazzi. You know, you're just kind of like walking around, and you just kind of you look down. You know, very subtly look down and shoot. And sometimes people aren't even aware that you're taking a photograph. So I think that also has to do with, you know, being a woman and being a woman used to being photographed, because you have to imagine that ever since 1915, when she goes to New York, joins the Marion Morgan's dancers, she is photographed constantly.
Yeah.
And she eventually becomes also a model for photographers like Man Ray, Nicholas Murray. Mm-hmm. So she's used to photography. She understands it. And she understands what it's like being on the other side. Mm-hmm. That's actually how she learns to be a photographer, is posing for these very famous fashion and art photographers. She learns a trade herself. But she knows what it's like being on the other side. And she knows probably how intimidating that be. And so she tries to be very careful when she takes those photographs in Bali. And I think that's what makes them really magical.
Yeah, there's such a sensitivity to them.
Yeah.
Well, they said Miguel had such a just way about him. Like, he was so personable and so kind to people that he seemed to like blend into those spaces very easily, spaces where he would be normally seen as an outsider.
He was really welcomed. I think it's right that he was welcomed in, I don't know, whatever space that he ended up with because of his personality.
So I'm sure that all helped.
Yeah. I think he was very charismatic.
That's the word. Thank you.
I think
you.
He always transmits that in the photographs, you know, portraits of him. He always kind of looks like a nice guy, you know, like somebody you can sit down and have a good chat with.
Thank you for sharing that too. I mean, there's just so many holes in the research. I mean, we can read all the books and try and find like articles, but there's just some things that we can't find over here in the US with our internet searches, our Google. So thank you so much for filling that in.
I mean, I have to say there's not a lot here either about either Miguel or Rosa.
Yeah, it was weird how we found we found Miguel through Rosa, only because there was one portrait that the Crystal Bridges Museum has of American art, which is, I mean, she is American, of course, as well. But yeah, we would have never run into her work otherwise, I think.
Have you heard of that museum? I think I told you a little bit about it.
Yeah, but no, I wasn't aware that they had a piece by her. Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting to me. And I think what happens to her is kind of the same experience that you have, is that sometimes you'll see one or two paintings at the most in a collective exhibition and, you know, in a group show. And then that's it, you know? And usually what happens is that her very famous portrait that's in Mexico City is in the Modern Art Museum. And it's usually just included in that kind of like group of women surrealist painters in Mexico, along Frida Kahlo, Leonora Carrington. Mm-hmm. And I feel like she just kind of gets lost in that group of surrealists. And it's really a shame because her work is quite fantastic. When you also think about, I think that's kind of something that they shared, is when you think about all the different mediums and disciplines that they experimented with, they were both, very multidisciplinary. That's quite interesting.
I think that also kind of ties into possibly how, and let me know if this is wrong, but possibly how Miguel started to view the world too. Like, something that was really phenomenal about that exhibition was just the overarching idea of seeing like a world that is on a macro level, very, very different. Like, there are all these different segments, and he breaks it down beyond just like borders. It's like borders within, well, different cultures within borders, right? But then when you get into the micro, like the very fine sort of characters that he does of people of different cultures, people of different backgrounds, it's all with like the same love and attention and just like showing the beauty in that difference instead of really segregating everything. I don't know if that makes sense, but
I think it does. I think it does. And I would just go back to maybe the gaze, you know, like he's, I think he's almost like a sociologist sometimes. I think there's a lot of that in caricature. You have to be a very keen observer to be a good caricaturist. And I mean, he was fantastic at that. And I think it's not just about the physical appearance of people. That, of course, that's the first thing that strikes you in a caricature, is the way they kind of exaggerate your features. But you have to be able to look even beyond that, right? Personality, context. And I think he was very good at that. And when you have that sort of gaze, I think you're able to go beyond cultural differences or ethnic differences. And I think that's something that he definitely was able to do.
His almost like his political characters seem to have more of that, those like outward looking appearances, kind of like exaggerated for comedic effect. Like there were some US presidents, there was Stalin, there were, you know, a bunch of people where, you know, Sigmund Freud, it's very much like Sigmund Freud exaggerated, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, when he does go into those more micro communities, there is like, I think, a sense of like warmth and love and attention to just like that moment in time, too. All you illustrator listeners should check out his work. Like,
yes.
It's incredible. It's really amazing to see how he handles different types of people and really gives them almost like a glow. Like there's a glow emanating from them.
Yeah. And I think it's also, I mean, of course, I didn't know him, but he gives me the impression that he was also generally curious about the world and people. And I think that if you combine that with his personality, I think that's a great combination, because then he was able to approach people in a very warm way socially. And then also like just be curious about what people are doing and why they're doing what they're doing.
Absolutely.
And that comes through. And I think she was also very curious, maybe in another way, maybe more curious for experimenting with art. I mean, but she was also very social. I mean, people who knew them and have written about them, they're always saying that, you know, they would throw these great parties and they would always have people over. Mm-hmm. And Rosa was a great cook, apparently. And she, I think she was just somebody like Miguel. They were both so creative that, you know, when you read these descriptions, they mention like, she was great at doing flower arrangements also. So like whenever there was a lunch, a dinner, a party, like the flowers were beautiful. The food was fantastic. Mm-hmm. Everybody was, you know, received very warmly received in their house. And they just seemed to be like nice people to be around. And I think that also helped transmit that warmth, as you say, in their work, especially Miguel.
Absolutely. And it's so good to see right now, too, like with the world being so polarized at the moment, to kind of remind everybody we're all human and we all we don't need to be so hateful towards one another.
And we all have more in common with one another than we realize.
Yeah.
The show needs to come to the States. No one needs to have heard of Miguel. No.
I think it should definitely go to New York or San Francisco when you think that.
For
I mean,
sure,
those are
sure.
like two places where he did a lot of his work.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's a really great show and I'm really glad that we got to see it. But I think just to go off of what you both were saying, I think just looking at his works alone, you can get the sense that he was really curious and sensitive and that he really looked. Mm-hmm. Like he really looked at people. You can tell when people observe a subject and they really take their time to learn like the ins and outs. And you can tell that he spent hours, you know, just looking, right? And that's something that we like to promote here is slow looking, like just people watch, just, I mean, you know, don't be like rude, but just sit and look and just experience things, like slow down, no phones, just see what you see.
Yeah. It's something that doesn't translate through like medium alone. It does, but it's like hard to like say like, this is how you do it. This is how you transmute this like thing that's within somebody onto like a piece of paper. But it's something that you just get from like looking, I think is what you're saying.
Yeah. Observing.
Yeah.
And we're artists. I don't know if I mentioned that. I should have mentioned that. Yeah. We're artists. So we see things both ways.
That's great. Yeah.
So are there other ways that Rosa and Miguel like inspired each other, like as an artist couple?
Yeah. I think it's important to say that not only did they inspire each other. I mean, we have talked about how Rosa introduces him to dance and to the Pacific cultures. Those were interests of hers for many years before they met. But I think Miguel also introduces her to her own roots. I have to say, Rosa's relationship with her family is still something that I don't really understand. It's something that I think she didn't talk much about. And so there's not a lot of literature on it. So at some point, she kind of breaks the relationship with her family. So she moves to New York, never goes back to California, except with Miguel many years later to do work in San Francisco. But she kind of breaks off contact with her parents, at least. So I'm not sure how much she really knew or was aware of in terms of her Mexican background.
Sure.
I think she was definitely interested in that because, like I mentioned, she would use it at least in her her dance in her dance career. But I think it's really Miguel who introduces her to Mexico and to Mexican culture they, like I mentioned, they come to Mexico before getting married in the late 1920s. And she became very, very interested in the ancient cultures of Mexico. Like I said, that was kind of a trend at the time. Mm-hmm. So the artists and intellectuals that they would have met or been in touch with during that trip would have also possibly have had some influence in that. But Miguel was somebody who studied these cultures very profoundly. So according to Juan Coronel, who is a Mexican art historian and he's Diego Rivera's grandson, Rosa Rolanda is the first artist, at least, who starts wearing traditional Mexican clothes, so like the embroideries that the indigenous communities produce, and also the first to use these sort of like pre-Hispanic influenced necklaces with like the big stones and to do the braids in her hair like the indigenous women do way before Frida Kahlo.
Oh,
so wow. That's probably Miguel's influence, that she starts not only understanding more about her Mexican roots, but also kind of like becoming more Mexican in the way that she presented herself. And that will also become very important in her own work because her painting does have a lot of elements of traditional Mexican popular culture, crafts, indigenous culture. Mm-hmm. That's something that permeates her work. And that would never have happened if she hadn't met Miguel, right? So there's that back and forth. But then there's the work that they do together, which is very interesting. Because unlike some of the other art couples that kind of had their own thing, if you think about, for example, Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera, like I mentioned, the more like symbolic or the more important, well-known art couple, they were kind of, they did their own thing. They had their own work, their own interests. But Rosa and Miguel are always collaborating since the very start. I mean, you have to think that the trip to Bali was kind of like their honeymoon. So they're just married. And they were already starting a collaborative project there with her photographs and his illustrations and his texts. And then the work that they do in San Francisco is also in collaboration. So first, they do the window displays for a shop in San Francisco. And then they do these murals that are at the show here in Mexico City now for the Golden Gates exhibition. But I think what's interesting there is not only did Rosa help Miguel paint those murals, because, well, like we said, she was also a painter herself, but she was also very important in the window display, which was kind of like the first step in this, because like I said, she knew how to do her own costumes. She knew her way around fabrics, around fashion, clothes. She could paint, she could draw, you know, she had all of these talents. She even made jewelry also. When they moved to Mexico, she did silver jewelry with William Spratling. So she was also somebody that had an eye for fashion and had an understanding of fashion. And so I think she was very, very important in that. The idea was that they would reflect the cultures of the Pacific in these window displays. And it was not only about painting a backdrop, but actually arranging the clothes and making costumes and sewing things. And so she was really very, very important in doing that. And then, of course, came the big mural project.
That is so cool. I did not know that at all. But that makes sense. It totally falls in line with everything she's good at and everything that she loves. One thing that I was just wondering, okay, so they did a lot of work in New York. They traveled to Bali. They did work in San Francisco. They could have lived anywhere in the world that they wanted. Why did they choose to stay in Mexico City?
I know what's really interesting is that they not only lived in Mexico City, but they lived in an area called San Angel, and an area, well, it's actually called Tizapan San Angel, which is even like more village-like, to say it in a way. So
more rustic.
So for people who are not from, people who are not from Mexico City, again, a very quick history lesson. So Mexico City was during the whole colonial period, so 300 years from 1521 to 1821, it was just the downtown area. So what we call the historic center. Mm-hmm. That was Mexico City.
Sure.
And in the 19th century, it started expanding to the surrounding areas. So, well, 19th century and early 20th century, Colonia Roma. Roma is very mm-hmm. famous, very popular among tourists. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the first developments that was done outside of this like old historic center. Here in the south, where I am, I'm in Coyoacán, just a few blocks from Frida Kahlo's house. So Coyoacán and San Ángel, they were like two little villages that were completely mm-hmm. independent of Mexico City until around from the 1920s to 40s, the city started expanding towards the south. And these two villages ended up kind of like engulfed by the urbanism of the city. And this process was really accelerated in the 50s. When UNAM, when the National University was built here in the south of the city. Mm-hmm. So these areas like San Angel, Coyoacán, Tlalpan, they still kind of have that village style in a way. Mm-hmm. So you have these cobblestone streets, you have little markets, you have a lot of old houses, families that have lived here for generations. And so Rosa and Miguel chose to live in one of these little villages. So I still haven't been able to track down if that's because maybe it was Miguel's family home and he inherited it. That could be one possibility. But there was a lot of artists that were moving to these areas. So Frida Kahlo was from Coyoacán, but Diego Rivera. Mm-hmm. So Coyoacán and San Ángel are like right next door to each other, right? And Diego Rivera did his house and studio in San Ángel. And then some other artists of the time, García Cabral. Cabral, El Chango was his nickname. If there's illustrators here, you have to go and see his work. He's one of my favorite artists. He was like an art deco illustrator. Absolutely fantastic. He also moved to San Angel. A lot of other writers, artists were also moving here. It was also in this context of kind of, again, going back to the roots of Mexican culture, the origins. There was a movement that in Spanish we call indigenismo, so like indigenism. It was kind of like the interest and reevaluation of indigenous culture, really like mm-hmm. giving it its place and its value. Sometimes I have to say with a bit of a colonial perspective, but it was very much a time when going out to these little villages to where the authentic Mexico could be found in a way. Like far from the urban center, far from, you know, skyscrapers mm-hmm. and just like the real authentic Mexico where you can still find handmade tortillas, you know? It's that kind of environment that they were looking for, a lot of the artists of the time. So that could have been another motivation. And I think also because, I mean, there's a very human factor is that there was work here. I mean, Miguel Covarrubias, because he was connected to these artistic and political circles, it was easy for him to get a job here, you know, and to get work and commissions. And once they moved here, Rosa basically left her career to the side. So she continued doing photography, and sometimes her work would be published in magazines in the US and abroad. So she became kind of like a press photographer. But she also left that very early on. She really dedicated herself to Miguel Covarrubias and his career. And that's very important to say. Like she probably could have gone on many, many years to continue to be a dancer and a photographer. And really her painting was kind of like her hobby. She didn't do painting professionally. She would even talk about this herself, that she wasn't interested in selling her paintings. She would make them for her friends. She would give them as gifts. She would just do it for fun. The jewelry experiment was also kind of the same thing. She never made like a commercial line. She would just give it to her friends. So I think she still wanted to explore her creativity, but she was really dedicated to Miguel Covarrubias. I mean, she would be like her driver. She would administrate the money, she would administrate the house. She was just dedicated to him so that he could really take off as an artist, as an anthropologist, as all of the different things he did, you know, like I said, he became the director of a dance school. So I think it was also that it was easy for them to make a living here in Mexico.
kind of going back to them inspiring one another. And I think Rose's kind of like unique look at the world. You were mentioning like the photography. You were mentioning her kind of approach when it came to approaching people for photographs. And really like embracing those different cultures, those different experiences. She has that really wonderful quote that we have in our episode, which I'm forgetting about. Do you remember it?
A dancer's brain is not in her feet. You've got to think about your work. And what's more, the audience has got to be made to feel what you are thinking. Mm-hmm. If you're supposed to be a lily swaying in the wind or any one of those things one might think of, you must behave as any one of those things would behave. Is that what you're trying to
say? Yeah, so I think that also really translates to Miguel, I think, as well.
That's
true. I love
that. Yeah. That's very true.
I don't know if this is the last question, but do you have a favorite piece from the exhibition of Miguel's work? If you could think about one.
That's so hard.
Yeah.
I know, it's hard. There's so many pieces.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love the Harlem Renaissance cartoons and illustrations. I think those are my absolute favorites, but also because my favorite period ever is the 1920s. So I love the way he reflects that the vibe of the time, you know, it's not just the fashion or the styles. It's just like you really get the sense of what the vibe, what the environment was like in
absolutely
that time in New York. And I think the Pacific murals are also absolutely fantastic. I was so excited that they were bringing those and showing those here because I had never seen them. So I think that was also quite fantastic.
He did some character sketches of like de Curico paintings, which I thought were phenomenal too. Like I really loved those. Those were great.
Yeah. That was a nice surprise. Yeah.
Yeah, those are really cool too. I mean, of course, his work about the Mexican cultures is also quite amazing. But yeah, I mean, if you were asking me what I would buy for my house, if I had the money, I would buy the Harlem Renaissance drawings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, the dance moves, so beautiful.
Yeah.
And I love that he showed I love that he showed like lower income people as well as it seems like upper income. I know that that's relative to Harlem, right? But showing like the different various communities within that like micro community too is really wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's inspired me to look more at people and draw, but draw. Like, I mean, I'm very observant.
And do more,
but actually like bringing what I see here down to like, you know, pencil and paper, like I'm really inspired to draw actually. Mm-hmm. And I'm still processing that show because there was just so much to see. There's so many mediums. And I think something that I really liked about his show was seeing how he uses color or lack of color in depending on the context. He's amazing at it. Mm-hmm. He was just so, so good. Just the way he uses negative space and all the grays. It's
and
just,
shape. Yeah.
I don't know why I'm drawn to grays, black, whites and grays. But I just think it's incredible when an artist can depict so much using so little color.
Mm-hmm.
And also I think he's really thinking about his medium, you know? He's thinking about how this will look on a magazine, a newspaper. I mean, because you have to think that magazines at the time, they would only use color on the covers, usually.
Oh, that's true. Oh, that's true.
And then in the interior pages, everything was black and white or monochromatic, because at the time they were also kind of experimenting with these crazy techniques where it would be like all on a green ink. Or like red ink. And yeah, it's really fun. Or blue. Yeah, kind of that monochromatic effect, but only with one color. So I think that also shows that he really understood his medium and his technique. Like he was very good at defining how he needed to solve his image in order to work in these formats and the constraints of these formats.
It shows through, for sure. Do we have time for the tea, the Rosa Miguel tea when they broke up, or
do we have time, Becca?
Yeah.
Yeah, we understand that the end of Miguel and Rosa's relationship was kind of messy. to say it lightly.
Yeah, so I think it's very sad for her, actually. I do have to say, no offense here, but I think it's very classic men, what Miguel Covarrubias did.
I'll just see myself out.
So he became that, like I mentioned, the director of this very important dance school. And to me, it's like really quite tragic because like we said, dance is what Rosa taught him. and what brought them together. You know, they met because she was a dancer and they were going to do a show together. And he meets one of the students at this dance school and basically cheats on Rosa with this student called Rocío Sagaón, and then divorces Rosa to marry her. That's basically what happened. But I mean, this is, again, from accounts by people who knew her, like Adriana Williams. Rosa became like really obsessed with this because there would be gossip and they would tell her, you know, call her home, or people would go see her and tell her that Miguel is in this relationship with a student. And they would even tell her that the student looked a lot like her when she was younger, which you have to imagine is, yeah, it's probably something that hurts a lot, especially, I suppose, like being a woman. I mean, of course, I'm speculating, right? Being a woman that's 10 years, well, 9 years older than your partner, aging is probably something that can be really an issue, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, for your self-esteem, especially at that moment. I mean, we're talking about early 50s, 1952. So that would have had to be something that probably hit her very hard emotionally. So it was very tough on her. Apparently, she also started to become kind of like I said, like obsessed with this, like kind of like almost following him around and that kind of situation. And so, yeah, eventually they divorced and he married this student, Rocío Sagaón, and basically was married to her until he died. So Rosa still lived about 20 years after that until 1970, which is when she died. And to me, the most tragic thing is that researching her, I went into, you know, these sites where you can, like genealogy sites, where you can look at birth certificates, death certificates. Yeah. So I wanted to see her death certificate. And it says housewife, like an occupation. It says housewife. And I thought, that's so tragic, like to think that she died, you know, without any recognition of her work as an artist. And with her heart broken, it's really quite sad.
Well, at least her work is being rediscovered now, it seems like.
Yeah. I think that's one of the best things that we can do as historians is bring some justice to the dead.
For sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Really nice way of putting it.
Yeah, we try to do that on our show and cover artists that, like Rosa, were overlooked, extremely talented, did a lot in their day. Because, yeah, they get overlooked and who knows for how long, but they have amazing work that a lot of artists today would find inspirational. And that's what actually drew us to Rosa's piece in that museum. It looks so contemporary, like it could have been painted yesterday. And so that really drew us to her work. And we're like, this is so cool. Why hasn't anyone heard of her? And again, like a lot of artists today, especially since illustration is so popular with younger students these days, like they could definitely connect to this. And this was made almost 100 years ago. Like it blows my mind still. Her paintings. So anyway, that's why we're here today.
Yeah, no, I think she was a really good painter too. And I think her style, like you said, I hadn't thought of that, but it is very sort of an illustration kind of style. Maybe that is also an influence of Miguel in her work.
Seems like it, a little bit. Thank you so much for joining us. Where can we send people to check out your work?
Well, I have my own podcast, but it's in Spanish. You can go to my YouTube channel, which is my name, Vika Duncan. Vika is written with a V and a K. So you can find me there. And I also do this TV show, which you mentioned, El Foco. That's on the network ADN 40, so ADN 40. You can also find it there on YouTube. We walk around Mexico City and talk about its history. You can find my name in every social media platform. Yeah, you can send me a message through there too if you want to know anything else about Mexican art.
Awesome.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Becca. We super appreciate it.
Yeah, this was
very enlightening. And of course, like we're huge fans of your work. So to have you here today was amazing.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here and to talk about Mexican art. So I hope it won't be the last time.
No, probably
not. We have a lot of Mexican artists we're looking at. So, listeners, new ones and old ones. I mean, that's not what I meant. I meant like if you just got here or you've been here.
No matter what your age.
Correct. Yeah. We welcome everybody here. Mm-hmm. We'd love to hear your thoughts on Miguel and Rosa's work.
Remember to rate, review, and subscribe so we can reach more folks like you.
Nada menos que cinco estrellas.
Go to artsicepod.com, sign up for our free newsletter so you can get alerts for our latest episodes, sans the algorithms.
The algorithms, yes. We could always use your support in creating these episodes, so please grab some merch. I know our wallets are tight.
We want to thank everybody who has been buying t-shirts.
Yes.
Thank you so
stickers,
much.
Stickers. Yeah. All
we pay
things.
For so much shit to just keep the show running, so we really, truly appreciate
and,
it.
Well, and anything helps. If it's tight right now, we understand.
Oh, yeah.
Liking, subscribing, passing the word along, we appreciate
it. Yeah,
any
if you can't do
it.
Any of that, like, seriously, leave a comment on YouTube, follow us, share it with a friend,
a review,
on a CD,
please.
Give us a review. Yeah, good one.
On all of your devices.
We will be back soon with a new episode. And don't forget, your chamaco could eventually one day meet their partner and go on a world tour bringing something. They could do that. They could do that. We don't know your kid, but we like to believe in your kid.
Oh, you're saying their actual child.
Yeah, your chamaco.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, don't forget your chamaco could also hit their teacher in the head with the ruler. I'm not condoning it. I'm just saying like
it
that could happen.
It could happen.
It could happen.
Maybe,
could happen.
You know, consider those like silicone.
Okay, bye.
Rulers.
Bye.
That are kind of wobbly.
Bye.
So they just kind of slap. They don't crack.
They slap.
Slap, don't crack. Say no to crack. Say yes to slap.
No.
Bye.
Bye.